This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Cosmic Shed. Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew and it's May the 4th, Star Wars Day. So we have an interview for you with Mark O'Connell, the author of Watching Skies, Star Wars, Spielberg and Us. It's a memoir that explores our nostalgia for that wonderful period in the 80s. And Ty caught up with Mark this week to have a chat with him about all that lovely 80s stuff. That's coming very soon, but I thought it was probably worth us just revisiting that interview that we did with Lee Towersy. Lee Towersy is, of course, R2-D2, the man who controls R2-D2 in the recent films. He was a fan, of course he still is, but now he gets to control R2-D2 in the films. And this interview was actually originally in our advent calendar back in December, but a couple of people have said, why don't you put that again on the May the 4th episode? So here it is, and we go straight from it into the conversation between Ty and Mark O'Connell. How did you get the job?
He says a man called Oliver Steeples called him to ask if I could join him for a trip to Pinewood to explain how we built our droids. A few meetings at Pinewood Studios later, we had one which turned out to be a job interview, and we both left the meeting having been offered jobs with Neil Scanlan's CFX team.
Is there anything else that we can see you're working?
He says he doesn't get much time off. Oliver left after The Force Awakens, but Lee has continued to look after the R2-D2 and operating him on every film since. He built the ALT track droid seen in Rogue One and Solo. He is also part of a team assisting with many other builds, along with running regular maintenance on the droids to keep them as reliable as possible when on set.
Any funny stories or anything that happened on set when you were filming that you can share with us?
Oh dear, I'm afraid our little tin friend is not complying. He says he's signed NDAs.
Oh, fair enough. But do you have a favourite R2 moment from the films?
He says that one of his favourite moments was operating R2 on the Falcon during The Last Jedi. When they shot the scene where R2 wakes up and drives over to Master Luke to talk to him, it felt like a special scene at the time, and he feels like it turned out to be pretty good in the film. When they reached Master Luke, they switched out the three-legged remote control R2 for the two-legged version. Jimmy V was inside the two-legged R2 at the time, with Lee performing the head movement via remote control. R2 says people have asked him if the Leia projection was shot after Carrie Fisher's passing. It wasn't. They shot that before her death and was always meant to be in that scene. It turns out it was a nice nod to Carrie Fisher in her memory.
Welcome to this special May the 4th episode of The Cosmic Shed. Mark O'Connell, author of Watching Skies, Star Wars, Spielberg and Us, which kind of makes you, Mark, the perfect person to talk to on this hallowed day, as it's a time when everyone kind of looks back fondly at the Star Wars films, as well as a lot of the films from that era, which kind of sparked the launch of Amblin and Industrial Light and Magic and all the kind of film companies that we love and grew up with. Tell us about your book and how and why. What prompted you to write it?
Well, hi, and happy Star Wars Thanksgiving Day. I wrote a James Bond book called Catching Bullets, Memoirs of a Bond Fan. And a different set of publishers sort of very loosely, it was half joked, half serious, said, have you got a Star Wars book in you in the same vein and the same mold? And that's exactly what I wanted to do next. So it all fell into a gorgeous place. But I felt there was more to my thoughts and remembrances of those movies than just the original Star Wars trilogy. To me, that time is also tied in with Jaws, Poltergeist, Raiders, E.T., Ghostbusters, Gremlins, all the obvious candidates. And suddenly it just fell into a place then. So it was sort of the book is a sequel prequel to my Bond book, but it's very much its own thing. And in fact, it's actually set before as well. So it's a Star Wars prequel. So I don't know what can go wrong.
The book follows your introduction to these films and this world. What was your gateway film into this whole 80s sci-fi landscape that so many of us watched?
Like a lot of us, our sort of entry points into these franchises are always upside down, backwards and completely out of sync, especially for guys perhaps in the 30s and 40s. We didn't have access to these movies beyond perhaps the VHS, you know, the video store and television specials and what was perhaps broadcast on Boxing Day or New Year's Day. So my first inkling of all of that world was October 82 when I saw my first imagery and scenes and movement, because it wasn't just stills in a magazine or a book. It was the first time I was seeing moving clips of Star Wars: A New Hope. I was my mother had a breakdown, basically. I the book's not afraid to go there, and there's a great chapter called Obi-Wan Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which hopefully will make reasons obvious. I was visiting my mum. She'd had a broken spirit and a breakdown, and these days she wouldn't have even got into the hospital she went in to. But I was visiting on a Sunday night, and I remember it was the Vader Leia scenes in the first act of the film, and I remember them booming along the corridors of this old Victorian a sanatorium or whatever they used to be called. So that was my first inkling. But then obviously I didn't really see it. I think visiting hours ended, so I probably went at the first ad break, and I didn't really see it. And then E.T. Came into my life, and then Close Encounters. So yeah, it was that sort of 81, 82 period.
But what was it about this era that obviously Spielberg and George Lucas came up with Francis Ford Coppola and Martin Scorsese as the movie brats in 70s Hollywood? But what was it about these two individuals that kind of just launched this whole transformation in American blockbuster cinema?
I think if we knew, we'd all be doing it. But I think it was timing. I think it was their youthful post-war enthusiasm. They were kids of a TV generation, and they weren't afraid of TV like a lot of film directors and studios and heads of production were. They were fearful of this little popular box in everyone's front room. And so Lucas and Spielberg, first off, they were a post-war byproduct of just movies and TV, which is a great place to start from. I think obviously the 60s paved the way. I say this early on in the book, Jaws didn't happen overnight. Star Wars didn't happen overnight. There was little seedlings along the way. Films like Bonnie and Clyde, Easy Rider, Planet of the Apes, Last Picture Show, French Connection. And then I feel it changed with American Graffiti in 73. And that gave George Lucas, particularly with a bit of Coppola help, that gave him a bit of momentum, and then he was finally able to sit down and work out that space saga. The book pretty much centres on Spielberg and Lucas, but obviously brings in Donna and Reitman and some of the other boys at the party as well.
He's lost. He's alone. And he's 3 million light years from home.
For nearly 3,000 years, man has searched for the lost Ark of the Covenant.
Steven Spielberg presents The Goonies, a Richard Donner film.
Raiders isn't just a great film because we love it. E.T.'s not just a great film because it made lots of money. And Star Wars isn't just an epic landmark movie because we all went wow at the opening shot. It's because those films, they changed cinema. Star Wars changed exhibition timings, exhibition practices, the relationship with the studio and the exhibitor was strengthened a bit. Lucas was very adamant that films be presented properly. And E.T. was the most pirated movie of all time. That means it was the most watched at home movie of all time, you know, in the early 80s. So I'm trying to look at the sort of cultural, social resonances as well. But all of it's framed in this personal VHS 80s flared kid world. It's not a hefty academic tome.
And you can kind of see the impact today. All the kids that grew up with these films, they are all adults our age. A lot of them are in charge of studios or directors themselves, and there's this whole new generation of directors that were kind of raised on these films, like J.J. Abrams and Matt Reeves and Colin Trevorrow. Obviously, nostalgia for the 80s is a massive part of pop culture today with Stranger Things. Do you think it's only natural that we look back at this era because of the effect that it had on us? And do you think it's almost a problem in terms of the films that we're getting today, and that all of them seem to be slight reboots, sequels or retreads of everything that came before it?
I think the history of pop culture is the history of nostalgia, and maybe whereas, as some people have noted, we've weaponized nostalgia in terms of our politics, I think nostalgia is really, there's a real force of nostalgia at the moment. I think it's fueled in a lot of ways, and one being that, yes, like you say, we've got this new guard, this wave of commissioners, producers, writers, directors, cinematographers, special effects guys. These are the people that grew up with the same films we did, but they're now in charge of those departments at ILM and, you know, Warner's and Marvel and beyond. So I think that's pulling into it. We've always looked back a little bit, you know, although I cannot imagine that perhaps in the 60s everyone was obsessed by the 20s, you know. So when you look at it sort of in chunks of time and look backwards, I find it odd. I think it was also, there was a lot of technology bouncing around the 80s. It was a new, it was like almost sort of an emancipation of cinema. I say this in the book, where the 50s and 60s and a bit of the 70s, my parents' generation, they would go to the movies. But after that, the movies started to come to us, whether it was through the merchandise, the toys, the VHS, or that VCR home revolution. And I think that that was a real key thing, that when those movies became accessible and we could buy them, they were still stupidly priced, and we, you know, to get a copy of Star Wars or Superman the movie was still a sort of societal step up. It was like akin to having a new microwave or a cordless house phone. So I think there's a lot of that, plus there's a bit of politics, and literally we're all a bit older. And then look what we're surrounded by. We are surrounded still by the movies, the Marvel in the same way slightly, but Star Wars, Indiana Jones might be back, Rocky, Bond never went away. It's all not quite gone away.
No, there is this catering to our inner child. Like, no matter how deeply we know that it might disappoint us.
And it is something that man was not meant to disturb. It is protected by forces beyond imagination.
We kind of crave it anyway. There's going to be a fifth Indiana Jones film. There's going to be a new Ghostbusters film. There's always talk of Gremlins 3. Interestingly, they're planning a belated sequel reboot of The Last Starfighter.
Alex?
Hi, Mags.
Alex. Is it you? I mean, is it really you?
On one hand, this is all very exciting, but the horrible thing I think about our generation is a certain sense of entitlement that inevitably leads to a horrible backlash. Do you think studios almost need to calm down, or will we just always just keep buying what they're selling? Because for us, it's just nostalgia is crack.
I think with certain film franchises, maybe they could slow down. And one thing I try to do in watching Skies is I don't isolate that period of time. I always say it was a magnificent 7, 8, 9 year period of cinema. It's a very small window of time, but it let in a lot of movie light. But I try and pull it forward. I try and, obviously, I talk about the new Star Wars films, the prequels and Last Jedi and Force Awakens. But I don't want to put it in a nostalgic isolation, so I try not to do that. But yes, there is a fan entitlement. I don't know if it's entitlement, I think it's ownership. I'm seeing it with Bond a lot at the moment. There was, you know, no recent title announced for the new Bond movie, and that got some fans just a little bit hissy and toxic, and assuming A, B, C, D, F, and J is wrong with the production. And that's ridiculous. That's silly. But I also, at the same time, do understand that sense of ownership. It's a bit like finding the sex or name of your new child. You want to know. So I get that. But I often just wish that some fans, and it's not all fans, and I think we've got to be careful of believing the hype of this. It's a community that would be toxic and angry and rude about anything. It just happens to be that cinema is what they know most about. If they knew more about politics or cared more about politics, they would be on political forums probably spouting the same stuff.
Yeah, it was heartening to see Marie Tran's reception at Star Wars Celebration. She got a standing ovation and a lot of love in the room over the backlash of her character Rose from The Last Jedi. Obviously at that event, the trailer for The Rise of Skywalker Episode 9 was unveiled. And it hinted at the return of the Emperor, which was interesting to me in that it's almost like following the reception of The Last Jedi, J.J. Abrams and the Star Wars creative team might be going back to the well to again, appease a certain minority by almost giving them the Star Wars that they want, not the Star Wars that they need.
I can understand that, and you've when you lay it out like that, you get me worried. But as a writer, I think the whole idea of Palpatine possibly being involved, overseeing this, you know, nine films or six films later, I think that makes great poetic justice. I think I've always thought that. I thought, are we going to believe there's a second? It's like watching Titanic 2. We're going to believe there's a second iceberg, a second First Order or Empire? No, maybe the original guy was pulling some strings, or, you know, and I felt it was coming. I felt a presence in Palpatine's force. That doesn't sound filthy. And I'm sort of glad, and also very intrigued to see how they do it. But yeah, I don't, to be honest, something like Palpatine returning in whatever form, that would have been plotted out and thought out way before the release of Last Jedi. Okay. Not everything, fans often think that their online reactions to something really steers the story and creative decisions on every movie, and it doesn't. These things are often in production. You know, Last Jedi was way in production before Force Awakens came out. I remember being at Pinewood, and Force Awakens was still 6 months away, but Last Jedi was being prepped and, you know, costumed and designed and written. So I don't, it doesn't quite work like that. Yes, I think that the Kelly Marie Tran reaction was perfect and very, very, very justified, because that was a horrific little glitch. So I do wish some fans would realize that maybe in Alien no one can hear you scream, but in cyberspace everyone can hear you scream.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the backlash also came around the fact that a lot of people would have liked seeing Han, Luke and Leia again, but obviously I think if anyone's ever read an interview with Harrison Ford about Han Solo, I think he only came back with the condition that they killed him. And
yes,
it seems like the people that often are the brunt of the vitriol are not the people behind the decisions.
Yeah.
And they inevitably seem to be female.
Yeah, I see a lot of misogyny and blatant sexism. I saw it recently with Bond, with the British writer Phoebe Waller-Bridge is involved now in the writing team.
That's very exciting.
It's amazing. Mm. And of course, she's got Star Wars history already, and she reworked, and she flea-bagged up some of her lines in Solo to great effect. But I'm like, well, why, you know, what's wrong with a woman getting involved in this? Like, this is ridiculous. It's 2019, it's 2020. We're like, really? Are we doing this?
It staggers me that a lot of vitriol is aimed at Kathleen Kennedy being the head of Lucasfilm, when this woman single-handedly, in many cases, produced some of the greatest films of these people's childhood, Indiana Jones films, Back to the Future. She was there alongside Spielberg for like 20 years. This woman knows what she's doing.
Yeah, one of the craziest things, some comment I saw was, Kathy Kennedy clearly doesn't know how to produce a movie. And like you say, this is the woman that produced Schindler's List, E.T., Jurassic Park, Alive, American Tale, for God's sake. It's like, she does know what she's doing. I also feel some fans don't quite get that it's cinema, it's art. It might be mainstream art, but Star Wars, Gremlins, E.T., they are pieces of cinema. They're pieces of sort of creative art. And having this sort of mass fan consensus isn't how art is created. I saw a great response to someone around that Last Jedi furore, where someone said, but you do know this. Oh, it was where someone tried to crowdfund a remake of Last Jedi. And they said, we have got X amount of money, and I did a sort of little calculation. I thought, well, you've got 1% of the budget of Last Jedi already. And someone just responded to me and said, you do know this isn't how art works. If I don't like a book or an episode of Game of Thrones, I am not going to go onto a Patreon site and say, hey guys, I really didn't like what A, B, or C did in Winterfell. I'm trying not to give any recent spoilers away here yet. I want to remake it. Are we all cool with that? Because these guys don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, I look forward to those guys deciding on how they're going to do a script by consensus with however many people back their project.
I always say, go and make a one-minute Star Wars movie, whether it's you in a forest with your Star Wars toys, which I've done, and not that long ago as well, just mucking about with mates. But go and make a one-minute film, then go and edit it, then go and upload it, and just try and see what that process is. Then do it 120 more times, so you've got a to our film, and then put it out there. And I think people just over or underestimate the complexities and the challenges that go into creating anything. I mean, you must know this. I know writing a book, you don't always get the timeline you want. You don't always get the imagery or the font that you want, or the editing process that you'd like. That's not how all of the things we love and are out there in public domain are made. Bond, Star Wars, they're forever just navigating challenges. There's not much actually wrong with Master Bond.
Let the past die. Kill it. If you have to. That's the only way to become what you were meant to be.
I love it.
What I love about it is it was a piece of cinema first before it was a Star Wars movie. It for a Star Wars movie, Episode 8, to end with where we don't quite know what's going to happen next, that is a real trick. That's a real triumph, I think, for that film.
You can only imagine the backlash The Empire Strikes Back would have got in a world of Twitter. Like you mentioned, the Bond franchise, that's a franchise that evolves with the times. And obviously, Lucasfilm have said that after Episode 9, there's going to be more Star Wars films, just not on an annual basis like there has been. Obviously, Game of Thrones, Benioff of Weiss have been apparently given a trilogy deal, and so's Rian Johnson. What would you personally like the future of Star Wars to look like? We've got the Mandalorian TV series coming, which looks fascinating. I can't wait to see that. So where do you see the franchise going, evolving?
After Solo, I really, really wanted them just to put the brakes on a bit. But that's nearly a year ago now, and I'm getting a little sort of episode hungry and a bit sort of, I want to see Stormtroopers again and hear John Williams. So I'm also a fan. I there's been me castigating fans. I am also a fan, so I do actually quite like the meth that my dealer gives me now and then. After Episode 9, I love the fact we don't know. When we hear the phrase "the rise of Skywalker," I think it's almost going to be a movement. I don't know if it'll be based on one or two characters, I'm sure, but I think it'll be a movement, an uprising, and I think that possibly opens out these episodes. Whether we see an episode 10, who knows? But then we were never going to see an episode 1 to 3 or an episode 7 to 9. Time and box office, Strange Beasts. But I do feel that the momentum Disney have got with Star Wars, if you just imagine all those, those corridors and offices and hangars and design teams and creative tanks, I think they're not going to drop the ball on that. They don't want to put it into storage. So that, when they say we're going to hold off a Star Wars story or two, I will wait to believe that, because I think they will come back. And oddly, I think one of the best films, I think Rogue One is a stunning piece of cinema and a great Star Wars movie. So possibly, if you looked at it, it's probably the strongest of the four they've done recently. So I think the future is bright for Star Wars. And I think we will have more movies.
We've passed on all we know. 1,000 generations live in you now. But this is your fight.
Are there any films from that era that you like to give voice to that might have fallen by the wayside amongst the Star Wars, the Indiana Jones and the E.T.s?
The hardest problem I had when I was writing the book was what I had to leave out in the end. And I left out a couple of big boys, but then it's a book about 80s sci-fi, so I can always do a sequel, maybe. I would say Krull. Krull is my guilty pleasure. And I would have said Flash Gordon, but I saw it on the big screen about a month ago, and I was like, oh, it's a visual.
It's a visual treat, but yeah.
Yeah, it didn't play as well as I remembered, and that's something about being an adult, looking back at those movies. But Krull always had a lot of time for it. I loved Krull and its weird, fake, faux Star Wars world. I mean, I remember lots of weird titles. I mean, Explorers isn't that unknown. There was this film called The Sheriff and the Satellite Kid that starred Carrie Guffey from Close Encounters, which was this slight Close Encounters cash-in about this little alien boy that came and hooked up with a sheriff in Midwest America. And I always remember that one. And The Cat from Outer Space, which was this 78 Disney live action movie. But the hardest thing to leave out, although I feel that might be a future book, is the Star Trek Genesis trilogy. Obviously, we all give great love to those movies, but I really, really wanted to put them in. So I was trying to sort of, and in the end, it was just space. You can't go with everything. But I was just trying to shoehorn some, you know, Spock, Khan, Voyage Home stuff in there when I could.
Well, your book is a fantastic trip down memory lane, and there's photos of you at, like, the locations from Jaws and Ghostbusters and your experiences at Pinewood Studios. Where can people find your book, and where can they find you if they want to learn more?
Well, Watching Skies, Star Wars, Spielberg and Us is out there in all good bookshops and e-stockists and anywhere. If you just put in hashtag Watching Skies on Twitter, Facebook or Instagram, you'll no doubt find me very quickly. So I'm out there in that respect. I've got a website, markoconnell.co.uk, which is a sort of storage space for all my Star Wars, Spielberg and Bond thoughts. And yeah, I'm out there, so come find me.
And when can we expect the follow-up focusing just on Star Trek?
Well, I've got like millions of followers. I mean, you know what it's like. It's like the hardest thing is to pick what next, but you've got about five in your head at any time. It'll be a little while off, yeah. I'm working on something that might be the third part of this trilogy. Watching Skies was the centrepiece. But I'm not there enough to announce it yet.
Well, as soon as it's done, we'll have to get you back in the Cosmic Shed to discuss it.
Brilliant.
Thanks, Mark.
May the Force be with you. I went there. May the Fourth be with you. Let's do that. It's the right day.
May the Fourth be with you too.
Sadly, we lost Peter Mayhew, Chewbacca, this week, and we can only send our best wishes to Peter's family and to all the friends and fans that he has around the world, and what a wonderful legacy he leaves for us all. We'll be back very soon with some more episodes. I know we've got somebody who's a science advisor for Star Trek Discovery and the Stargate universe. We're going to do that episode all about Godzilla before the new film comes out. But don't forget to go back into the archive if you've not heard our interviews with Warwick Davis, Jonas Suetamo, who of course plays Chewbacca, having taken over from Peter Mayhew. And we also have a couple of other Star Wars related episodes, including the physics of Star Wars with the man who literally wrote the book on it. I'll post a link to all of those, of course, on the Cosmic Shed website, thecosmicshed.com. And thank you very much for listening. The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
Kelly Marie Tran.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.